Electricity is such a mundane part of life, we really don't often think about it, except when your AC goes out after a hurricane and you're left sitting for days in the Florida heat. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WUSF Public Media, I'm Robin Sussingham. Florida's power companies have invested billions and billions of dollars to harden the electrical grid since the hurricanes of 2004 and 2005. Could you tell? If you lost power after Hurricane Irma, and 6.5 million homes did, it may have been hard to discern how things have improved in the last dozen years. Today on Florida Matters, we're talking about electrical power. My guests here in the studio are Anna Gibbs, a spokeswoman with Duke Energy, Dr. Ralph Fair, a power systems expert and an instructor at the University of South Florida, and from Tallahassee, we have Nick Evans, a reporter at the NPR member station WFSU. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you.
Anna, the people at Duke Energy have had time now since the hurricanes to debrief. So what's the feeling there about how the power grid performed during this emergency?
Since 2004, we've actually invested more than $2 billion into our system. And we have seen improvements. If you were going to compare to Charlie, for example, in Charlie, Duke Energy had lost about 500,000 customers. And at that point, it had taken us about 9 days to get everybody back on. And compared to Irma, we lost about 1.3 million in this case. And in this time, it took us about a week to get everybody back on. So we do see improvements. But as you can imagine, if you're the person that did take a week to get your power back, and, you know, without AC, it doesn't seem good enough.
Right. People were frustrated. So, Ralph, the main reason we lost power was falling trees, right?
That was certainly a big factor.
Yeah, the Bradenton Herald reported that 5 million customers of Florida Power and Light lost power. There was damage to all 27,000 square miles of their grid. So why weren't those power lines buried?
You know, that's a question that comes up all the time. Why don't we just put the power lines underground? Doesn't that fix all the problems? And the short answer is no, it doesn't. It doesn't fix all of the problems. It will help with some of the problems, but it also introduces different problems. When people talk about undergrounding the electrical system, the first thing that comes up is cost. It is expensive, but then you can make the argument, well, isn't it worth investing money if it's going to pay big benefits? And there's an argument to be made there. But it's not just the cost. You know, when you put your utilities underground, they're suddenly susceptible to other types of problems. The wind issue and flying debris no longer is a concern, but now you have flooding concerns you have to be careful of. Also, when the system does have a problem, diagnosing the problem and repairing the problem becomes very difficult, very expensive, and very time-consuming. So a problem that might take 30 or 60 minutes to fix on an overhead system could very easily take days on an underground system. And these are things that people need to be aware of. You know, the underground technology is not a silver bullet solution. It might be a good part of a long-term strategy, but certainly not for every circuit, certainly not to solve every problem.
And Nick, I know that's something that legislators are probably going to be looking at. You know, there have been complaints that Duke Energy put less money into its tree trimming budget, and that might have contributed to its 1.3 million outages. And legislators say they're going to look at that and into the rate increases that are expected to help power companies pay for hurricane recovery. But what's the first thing that you think legislators are going to tackle when it comes to the state's power grid?
I think the first thing that lawmakers are going to look at is immediate recovery after the hurricane. I know that that has been a big issue in a number of Senate panels in particular. The Senate Appropriations Chief Jack Latvala is from Clearwater, and I know that that area dealt with quite a bit of outage after this. And he's definitely got his eye on how recovery went and how preparation went. So eventually, I'm sure that they will begin discussing how the power companies dealt with getting ready for this storm, both like right ahead of the storm and in the months before it. But really, the first item that they're going to be tackling is immediate recovery.
And Anna, are some of those recovery costs going to be passed on to the customers?
So utility companies do have the ability to do that. We did not ask for recovery in Matthew. We're crunching the numbers for Irma, but it is something that is possible for utilities to do. In the process, you know, you're going to see that happening in the next several months is likely what happens. But I don't have a particular number yet specifically for Duke. But it is, again, something that is available to utility companies depending on the cost.
Well, in the past, what might someone see on their bill? Another $10 a month?
Right. So it's typically not that much. But just to give you perspective, for example, specifically for Duke, we had in the $60 million in our storm reserve. That just kind of gives you perspective about what's kept in our storm reserve. But it wouldn't typically be something like that. And you also have to remember, we have 1.8 million customers, 35 counties. So even a larger number is divided among many of our customers. And it's not over like a 6-month period, typically over at least a year. And sometimes there's wiggle room in how to recover also. Mm-hmm. So we definitely don't want our customers panicking and think that all of a sudden they're going to see a huge increase or anything like that. And everything's public, so they definitely know, what's coming ahead before anything's put on their bills.
All those convoys that we saw of the out-of-state linemen coming in, I mean, big heroes. I mean, we all wanted to throw rose petals at those convoys. But who pays for that? They're not paid by their own power companies wherever they come from.
No, those are incurred by, obviously, any company that chooses to bring them. We are definitely part of, it's called mutual assistance. Most of the companies do use it. Obviously, we are very grateful for the assistance. We would have never been able to get for us. In the first 4 days, we basically got 1 million people back on. And it's definitely part of the process. We're very cooperative in the way that not only do we use them, obviously, during hurricanes, but if you think of ice storms or snowstorms that happen up north, we reciprocate and return the favor when those storms happen up north. But you are correct in that whichever utility is asking for the assistance does usually pick up the cost for that type of mutual assistance.
And over 12,000 of these workers helped out with Hurricane Irma. It wasn't a small number. Over 12,000.
Right, mm-hmm. Right, and that's just for Duke Energy. We had 12,000 just for Duke Energy.
Just for Duke Energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Dr. Ralph Fair, I got an insert in my Florida Power and Light bill that explains where the power comes from. And it says that nearly 70% of our power is from natural gas. Is that too much? Are we too dependent on one type of power?
Well, that's a very good question, and of course it depends who you ask. Everybody has an opinion on this. I personally think yes. I think we have a lot of eggs in one basket, and a lot of risk does come with that. Now, natural gas is a very attractive fuel. There are a lot of benefits behind it. You know, it's cheap, it's abundant. Out of all of the fossil fuels, it's probably the most carbon friendly. It produces the least amount of carbon emissions, you know, compared to coal and other fossil sources. So there's certainly a lot to be said for it. But from a technical standpoint, there are issues with natural gas. Natural gas is very difficult to store. It pretty much has to be piped to the facility real time. So now you have a potential availability problem. And, with any resource, diversity is important. You really want to have a mix of fuels. You know, if something suddenly happens either economically or maybe there's a production problem, there could be all kinds of issues that would jeopardize the supply of natural gas.
Yeah, those prices fluctuate. Mm-hmm. So I remember back in 2011 reporting on the Crystal River nuclear power plant, talking to the CEO of Duke Energy, or was it Progress Energy at that time?
Progress
Energy at that time. He was saying how expensive natural gas was and how much it would cost if they had to take those customers who were using nuclear from Crystal River and put them on natural gas. Well, they never did bring that back online, and now natural gas is cheap.
And of course, there are other technologies too. You know, all of the renewable technologies, you know, primarily in Florida here, we think solar. Solar can be a great tool to use to help supply the energy, but all of these sources have limitations. They have, you know, pros and cons, and the big picture really needs to be looked at.
Right. And on that solar, Anna, so it's official now. Duke Energy reached a settlement with the Public Service Commission. They're not going to be building a nuclear power plant in Levy County. They are going to be building some solar plants. But hasn't Duke Energy been charging customers all these years to build those plants that now aren't going to get built? Wasn't that put into bills?
So I think you're speaking of the Levy plant. So that is correct. There had been some previous charges for Levy. But what we have basically done is said, again, this is something that the Public Service Commission allows us to do. It's whatever investments we have put in the process of trying to build that plant, we're allowed to recover from the customers. And so at this point, even though we had incurred some additional cost, those additional costs we're no longer going to collect because at this point we're deciding no longer to build Levy. But in addition to that, in this agreement, the settlement agreement that we have with the PSC, it's going to allow us to do some other amazing things. A $6 billion investment in everything from, you know, smart grid to solar to even the electric charging stations for vehicles. And just because we're just talking solar, we're talking 700 megawatts of solar in Florida over the next 4 years. So we're really excited about this agreement. We really think it's a win. It even gives additional billing options for customers. Basically the things that customers have wanted from us. And we didn't just come up with these great ideas by ourselves. We had what we call interveners, basically consumer groups and other parties who worked with us before we ever went to the PSC, who kind of speak on behalf of our customers and our customer groups and said, this is what we want. So this really is a collaborative effort in trying to give our customers and customer groups what they're asking
for. Well, $6 billion is a lot of money. And solar plants don't cost anything close to that, right? So this will be going into a lot of other endeavors.
Yes.
And
yes.
And right now, solar power accounts for 0.4% of power use in Florida. That's not very much. So you could triple that with this money, and then it would be 1.2%. I mean, is this going to make much of a difference, Ralph?
Well, it does in the sense that you're improving the diversity of your energy source, and that alone is worth pursuing. Solar technologies have come a long way. You know, when solar was first introduced as a technology for electricity generation, it was nowhere close to being cost effective. It had to be heavily subsidized to even be considered.
Right.
And even then, it was often a very shaky investment. The picture has changed there totally over the last, you know, just several years. Mm-hmm. It can be cost competitive now with other technologies. So that's made possible very much due to the fact that more and more is being deployed. You know, you have to get the technology out there to get the improvements in the field. And we're seeing that now with solar. So, you know, that's a very positive aspect.
You're listening to Florida Matters, and we're talking about the power grid. Our guests are Anna Gibbs, a spokeswoman with Duke Energy, Dr. Ralph Fair, a power systems expert and an instructor at the University of South Florida, and from Tallahassee, Nick Evans, a reporter at NPR member station WFSU. I'm Robin Sussingham. We'll be right back. I'm Robin Sussingham, and this is Florida Matters. After the hurricane and all the power outages, we're talking about whether our electrical grid has to be so vulnerable. Nick Evans, Clearwater State Senator Jack Latvala is taking on the power companies as an issue in his gubernatorial run. He's pointing out that his rival, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, has received far more campaign contributions from utility companies than he has. So it's interesting, Latvala is the Senate budget chairman, and the utility companies are big Putnam donors. I mean, how do you see this playing out during the legislative session?
Well, in terms of the legislative session, it's not totally clear yet, but in terms of making power companies an issue in the political race, I mean, yeah. This is pretty savvy. You know, like,
right.
I think that the big money from those particular sources was already gone. I don't think that there was any real shot of Jack Latvala pulling that money away from a company like Florida Power and Light that's funneling so much money to his gubernatorial rival. So highlighting it and saying, you know what, I'm not going to take any more of this money, and I think that these power companies should instead put those investments into the grid, I'm sure plays really well with a lot of voters. Mm-hmm. So not surprising, a very savvy move from an old hand in Tallahassee.
And as I think you've pointed out, it hasn't, they've already put billions of dollars into the grid. And with the campaign donations, you were talking a couple $100 million, I think. Even if they did that, it would sort of be a drop in the bucket of what they are actually investing
in
the power
grid. It would be very little, but it's good politics.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to get back to solar for a second, Ralph. This agreement to build more solar plants. So it was reported in the publication Energy Wire. This Texas company, Sunnova, I think it's called, has 6,000 customers, solar customers in Puerto Rico. And I don't think that it's done them much good to be on solar instead of conventional power. They still had 60% of their customers without power because once the grid was down, they were out of luck.
Well, if you look at the case of Puerto Rico specifically, it actually does make a big difference because with the absence of solar, virtually all of the electricity generated in Puerto Rico comes from burning oil. And oil is a very expensive and a relatively dirty fuel. So electricity costs in Puerto Rico tend to be very high. Mm-hmm. And solar is a great example of solar bringing the cost down. When you can reduce the cost of providing electricity and electrical service in an area like that, now you have capital freed that can be used to reinvest in the system to strengthen that grid. You know, the problem.
But it hasn't been done yet. I think that's a great point. But I think during this storm, it didn't actually help them keep their power. The power that they had might have been cheaper, but they didn't actually help them with their outages.
It's certainly a work in progress. You know, changes in this industry do not happen cheaply. You know, $1 million doesn't go very far in this business, so it takes a tremendous amount of capital, and changes don't come quickly. You can build new facilities, you can upgrade facilities, but in many cases, the benefit isn't seen for a period of time. So there is a time lag. So a lot of the Caribbean islands, for example, are on a very good path, I think, by using more solar and freeing up capital to improve the infrastructure. But the devastation we saw in Puerto Rico and some of the other Caribbean islands was because of the condition of the power grid. It was old. It was in need of maintenance. It had problems before the storms. You can look at many areas of the continental U.S. and make the same comment. You know, we have an old system here that does need maintenance in many cases. And that is an issue. So, you know, when you have an aging infrastructure, keeping it up to snuff is a very difficult job, and it gets tougher as time goes on.
Anna Gibbs, here's something I wanted to ask you about. There has been this phenomenon of people's electrical bills going up after this. And I saw it, on my local social media, this next door in Lakeland. Sure. Here's some comments. We had 4 days without power and we had a huge increase in our electric bill. Anybody else getting this? Someone else says, I find it interesting. I had 13 days without power and my electric bill hardly changed at all. Do you have any idea what's going on?
Sure. So I'll speak to Duke Energy specifically, but I'm going to guess it's the same for other utilities. When we have a hurricane, for example, if it just happens to fall during the meter reading period, what happens is your bill gets estimated. And that's exactly what happened to Duke Energy. So it just so happened that it was, you know, your typical bill cycle. So the bill was estimated. And it's a very automated system. So the bill gets estimated, it gets sent out to our customers. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, obviously, you know, the bill, what would have been a regular bill, and honestly, it wasn't the obvious regular bill. We offered our customers various different ways to have that immediately adjusted. So for example, if a customer wanted to go ahead and pay that bill, they could pay that bill and then just get a credit later. Some people wanted and chose to do that. Other people actually, if they had the simple meter just outside of your home where it's easily accessible, they could actually just read it to our customer service representative and pay a real bill, the one, you know, that they read to our customer service. But they also, due to the hurricane, we weren't penalizing people. So if they actually were in a hardship and felt like they didn't want to pay that bill at all and just wait till the next bill, they could actually just skip that bill without any penalty and just pay. When I say please no, you'd still have to pay both bills. So it would be a almost like a double bill for 2 months, but they were able to do that and just delay billing. Again, these are things we look at, right? So how can we better handle it? Is there an easier way? We did what we could to make it better under the circumstances, but we understand people see that and go, what's going on?
Well, I think the larger question is how to improve the communication, because one of the biggest frustrations was just not knowing how long it was going to last. When is my power coming back on? And there were no answers.
Right. And I can definitely speak to that. And this is very specific to Duke Energy. We did have IT issues. And customers, we are so accustomed to immediate answers. And Duke Energy has those systems in place so that we have so many answers on what we call a blue sky day. So right now, if you go to our outage map and you have a regular outage, you are able to see where that outage is down to the street. It tells you what's wrong. It tells you when the outage started. It tells you the estimated time of restoration. You get texts. You can go online. We'll even tell you a truck's on the way. So our customers are accustomed to that level of what we call customer care.
Right.
Unfortunately, and this is all on us, and we take full responsibility, when the storm happened, our IT system, you know, when we had over a million people out, we had an issue with that system that communicates to our customers. And our customers, again, who are very accustomed to that system, did not get that communication. And so in addition to not having their AC, they did not have what they wanted to have, which is that
information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so one of the many things that we were looking at, one of the many things that we hope to improve, how can we make our systems better and how can we make our backup systems better? And if all goes wrong, how are we going to do that better?
Nick Evans, some of the oversight for the public utilities is with the Public Service Commission. And we just had one research organization, Integrity Florida, warning that the Public Service Commission is beholden to the utilities that they oversee. So it's kind of a fox running the hen house kind of situation. And they're calling on state legislators to address that. Can you talk about that?
You know, I think you kind of see some level of this in just about every regulatory agency, whether at the federal or the state level. And just some of the things that happen at the PSC seem a little more egregious. Some of the things that they pointed out is that the way in which we nominate people for the commission, it's a five-member body, it was set up through this sort of Byzantine system where a group of people select a short list that then goes to the governor, who then selects the specific person. And the whole idea was to get politics as far away from this as you can.
It used to be elected positions where
right,
you'd have to actually
right.
campaign for it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. But as it tends to do, politics found its way in. And one of the things that they point out is that one of the newest members who's going to start, I believe, in January is a former state representative named Rich Workman, who doesn't have utility experience. And one of the guys that he's taking over for is a guy who's been on the Public Service Commission for a while named Ron Brousset. And the concern is that you're losing a guy who is willing to serve another term and has experience, and you're replacing him with a person who is a Republican state rep, basically. And that's about all that he can offer in terms of prior experience related to the position he'll be taking on. Some of their recommendations are a little unreasonable. Like one of the things they suggested is, you know, let's go back to an elected PSC, which how that would somehow get politics out of the system is beyond me.
Right.
But the concern that there does appear to be a lot of influence from companies like Florida Power and Light, like Duke, on lawmakers who are leaning on the members of that commission, it's hard for people on the outside looking in not to see some level of that and not feel a little concerned.
Do you have any comment on that, Anna?
I think I would only say that we work with both the regulators, and I think the settlement we just talked about is a great example where to make the system work, we have to work with everybody, our customers, our customer groups. And of course, you have to work with the regulators to make the whole system work. And that's the only way that it works. It's very public. It's everything that we do is of the public record. And as much as people may, you know, have that type of feeling, the other side of it, too, is that as much opportunity as we have with regulators, please know that the public has that same opportunity, too. So,
you know, I think one thing that I would point out, like there's so much information, but a lot of it is kind of discussed in ways that it's very, very difficult for the average person to really wrap their head around. And so although, yes, a lot of things that are happening in terms of policy are out there and available if you want them, it takes a lot of expertise often to really grasp the level of work that's being done on behalf of the companies and on behalf of the public through something like the Office of Public Counsel. It is all out there, but just because it's out there doesn't mean that the average person can really grapple with it.
I think that's a good point. Ralph, I want to ask you to kind of take the long view here. Our prices for electricity right now, how do they look? Are we paying a lot or a little?
They're low. And that's actually a problem because when the prices are so low for energy, initiatives like energy conservation become very hard to implement. Why do you want to save something that's so cheap? When you look at other areas of the world, Europe, for example, energy has traditionally been much more expensive in Europe forever.
I would say, yeah, I get what you're saying, because when it's expensive, you put more mm-hmm. money into alternative energy. But I would say the businesses that use that power mm-hmm. can say, you know what, I can hire two more people because my power bill is much lower. So there's definitely two sides. I mean, someone who's on a fixed income and has a lower heating bill in the winter rather than a higher heating bill is going to disagree with that as well.
Absolutely. It's always more than one way to look at it. And the other thing to realize with electricity is not just the cost of the electricity, but it's also the reliability. If you have a very low cost supply, that looks great on the balance sheet. But then when your manufacturing process has to shut down three times a day because of reliability problems, how much did you really save? So it's really not just cost that customers, and I'm talking industrial customers mm-hmm. here, should be focused on. It's a combination of cost and reliability. And the two go hand in hand, and they're inverse of each other. As one gets better, the other typically tends to get worse.
Do you think we'll see coal coming back into the market? There are technologies out there that make it a cleaner burning fuel. And the new EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, is drawing some heat because he's rolling back some of these clean power plan regulations from the Obama administration. I'm wondering if that's going to affect our electricity bills.
Yeah, that's a great question, Robin. The thing about coal is it's a plentiful source of energy. There's a lot of it. It is the highest carbon producer of all the fossil fuels. Coal is pretty much pure carbon, so when you burn it, you get a lot of carbon dioxide. You're right. There are clean coal technologies that will make coal much more environmentally friendly, but it is still a pretty, dirty fuel. And when you get right down to it, energy production is a dirty business. Even when you're looking at sources like hydroelectricity, even solar and wind power, there's a lot more environmental impact there than meets the eye of the general public. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. So the bottom line is when you generate large amounts of electricity, you are putting stress on the environment. Again, it's a matter of diversity, I feel, keeping things mitigated. You're gonna have environmental impact, but you have to keep the environmental impact under control. So will coal remain a slice of that pie chart that shows where all of our electricity comes from? I think so for quite a while. It's going to be a shrinking piece, and we're going to be using it differently. But I really don't see it going away anytime soon.
That's it for today's show. Anna Gibbs, Dr. Ralph Fair, Nick Evans, thank you all so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Robin.
We're planning to do more on this topic, including an upcoming show that delves into alternative energy. Let us hear your thoughts and your experiences. What's the best way to cope with a power outage? We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at Florida Matters. Florida Matters is produced by Stephanie Colombini, engineered by Craig George, and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Robin Sussingham. Thanks for listening.